The end of the year is the time when most film critics are at work compiling their 10 best lists. When Algene Harmetz looks back on the year in film, she reviews the behind-the-scenes trends, the trends that made production of the best and worst films possible. Harmetz writes about Hollywood and the business of movies for the New York Times. She's based in Los Angeles, near the center of the industry. Harmetz got her start writing for the fan magazines like Modern Screen and Photoplay. She has also written two books, The Making of the Wizard of Oz and Rolling Breaks and Other Movie Business. I spoke with Algene Harmetz earlier today from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. I asked her first if 1987 was a good year at the box office.
It was a spectacular year at the box office in some ways. I think that the amount of money pouring into theater wickets is going to be over $4.2 billion. Hollywood's best year was $4.1 billion in 1984. But you have to step one step back and take a really good look at that. The theater owners are exuberant. They have had a great year, but there's been so much product in the marketplace. Two Hollywood movies are called product. There's been so much product that a lot of pictures have failed very quickly. And I'm not just talking about big budget bombs such as Ishtar and Bill Crosby's Christmas movie, Leonard the Sixth. Talking about a lot of fairly good little movies that were pulled by the theater owners because there were more to replace them. So if you really look at this Christmas season, the people who come out best are the exhibitors and Paramount and Disney, which presumably have three of the five biggest hits in the marketplace, Three Men and a Baby, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Cinderella.
So in other words, the movies that are doing well are doing very well and are drawing lots of people to the theaters, but a lot of the movies that don't do spectacularly well just get lost and put aside to accommodate something else that might be a big seller.
Well, to accommodate something else that has a chance of being a big seller, at least. There are 100 movies waiting to get into theaters, then the law of supply and demand says that the exhibitors are in the catbird seat. They're driving. If there are very few movies and lots of theaters, then it's the movie studios that are in the catbird seat.
Well, this might explain something that I've noticed, that sometimes a movie comes to town, and if I don't rush out and see it the weekend it opens, I'm going to miss it. A movie like Bestseller, which opened earlier this year. Now, I heard it wasn't the greatest movie, but I didn't have a chance to make up my mind. The movie came and went before I had a chance to get to the theater.
I liked Bestseller quite a bit. The two actors in it, James Woods and Brian Dennehy, are both wonderful, and to watch them maneuvering in this taut thriller was a great deal of fun for me, but you're absolutely right. If a movie doesn't succeed in its first week, then it's very likely not to be there after a couple of weeks. It used to be, as I've been told by the executives in charge of distribution, it used to be that you could always get a movie open. That is, if you spent enough money, you could always get a good opening weekend out of it in terms of audiences coming and sampling it, and you could always keep it around for 2 weeks. Now, if it doesn't work, you won't keep it around beyond a week. And there are some movies, a good example is The Princess Bride, which really required time to build. And so Fox was extremely nervous because of the propensity of the theater owners to yank movies that weren't doing extremely well.
Sure, it sounds like it's impossible. It sounds like it's impossible to be a sleeper now.
Pretty much so, yes. That is exactly what's happened.
I think perhaps the most successful film of the year has been Fatal Attraction. It not only has drawn in big crowds, but it's continuing to draw them after months and months in movie theaters. Did anyone in the industry expect that to be the big hit it turned out to be?
No. That's what makes the movies fun. You can never quite predict. I think that once the movie was tested, which is the common way of looking at movies nowadays, and once the ending was changed because audiences threw things at the screen in the test screenings with an original ending in which Glenn Close commits suicide, once that was done, I think Paramount was pretty well assured that they had a movie that would be a success at the box office. But no one can predict a blockbuster, with two exceptions. You can predict a blockbuster, and a blockbuster is a movie that makes over about $100 million at the box office. You can predict one if it is a sequel to a successful movie. Everyone knew that Beverly Hills Cop 2 was going to be a blockbuster. And you can possibly predict one if you have one of the very rare stars like Eddie Murphy, who in a particular kind of movie is bound to be a major success.
I'm interested in this changed ending in Fatal Attraction. Now, I learned about this through one of your articles in the New York Times. Initially, Glenn Close was supposed to commit suicide by slitting her throat with a knife that had Michael Douglas's fingerprints on it. So she not only took her own life, she was basically condemning him to be sentenced to murder. And you'd said that audiences were so upset at this ending, they literally threw things at the screen. Now, why did the studio heads or whomever decide that they were going to test this ending and see what kind of reaction they got? And if they didn't like the reaction, they were just going to change the ending.
Well, movie directors have a certain amount of control, and this was the ending that the director, Adrian Lyne, liked. I mean, this was his ending. This was what he wanted. And he says still that he feels more sympathetic towards Glenn Close than audiences felt. That was one of the shocks for him. He kept his sympathy with her through the second act of the movie until she went out to their country house and started doing things like boiling rabbits. But audiences lost patience with her much, much earlier in the movie. That was something that Lyne did not expect.
But does this happen a lot, that a movie will be shown to get the audience reaction, and if the reaction is negative, that the ending will be changed?
It happens a lot that movies have research screenings to get audience reaction. Usually you try to make a research screening with the core audience of the movie. It's not very much use to you to take a movie about teenagers and invite an audience of 45-year-olds to see it and criticize it. So you go for screenings with the core audience. And now, recently, there has been a lot of changing the movies, not necessarily the ending, after the research screenings, but that's nothing new. It goes back to Irving Thalberg, the boy wonder of Hollywood, who was in charge of Universal in its early years and then the person behind MGM from 1924 till his death in 1936. Irving Thalberg said, "Movies are not made, they're remade." And at one point, in one of the, I think, Men and Bill, in a movie with Wallace Beery, he reshot an entire major sequence because Beery's shoes did not squeak when he was going down the aisle at, I think, a wedding. And so it wasn't funny. And when the movie actually came out with the squeaking shoes, it was very funny, and the movie was a box office success.
Well, who decides that there's going to be a research screening? Is it the studio head? Is it the director?
No, it's not the director. It's the studio.
Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking about how a lot of movies come and go in the bat of an eye, and that there's no chance for audience reaction, word of mouth, to build. Another trend that I've noticed living in Philadelphia is that it takes weeks for movies to come here sometimes. You know, they'll open in New York or Los Angeles and maybe San Francisco, and sometimes we have to wait 6 weeks, 2 months before a movie comes here. I'm still waiting to see Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. Why is that pattern so erratic? At least it seems erratic to me.
Well, this is the way that you can protect a movie. It's basically been used by the distributors of small movies or the major distributors when they have an art movie, a movie that they need to get good reviews in New York and good reviews and good response in Los Angeles before they send it out to other cities. Then, like Sammy and Rosie, like Room with a View, like Morris, it will come with an imprimatur, essentially, a little tag that says, hey, this movie got great reviews in New York, and it's a fine little art film. It's the way that they used to handle foreign films.
I see. So it's actually in order to improve the word of mouth and the advertising and reviews.
Yes. Now, some of the studios use a modified platform for major movies. Disney used that with Tin Men. They opened in about, I think 50 theaters maybe, because they trusted the movie, they trusted the word of mouth, but they knew that if they opened it in 1,000 theaters at once, nobody would go because the idea of the movie was so bizarre, a movie about aluminum siding salesman, and it didn't really have any major stars in it.
You know, it's amazing to me how office politics can affect the life or death of a movie. I've read, for instance, that The Last Emperor, the Bernardo Bertolucci movie, is not getting a lot of promotion because it's a former studio head who backed that movie, and now he's out, and his successor doesn't want to make this former studio head look good, so they don't care if the movie fails. I mean, is that true?
I don't think that's very true. I'm sure that there is some feelings, as there always is, that you want to see the guy whose job that you've taken fail, that you want to prove how much better you are than whoever came before. But it would be really dopey for a studio to kill a expensive movie, even though they only had a certain limited amount of money in it, for reasons of revenge. I don't think they did it. I think it's a lot more complicated than that.
You mentioned earlier that this was a terrific year at the box office for the movies that were successful. And so it was very good for the theater, for the theaters that showed the successful movies. Now, does the movie industry think that we are going to the movies with more regularity than we used to? I remember it seems just a few years ago that there was a lot of panic in the movie industry, that people were staying home more, watching television and cable more, renting home video more frequently, and that this was taking a lot of the profits away from the theaters.
Well, actually, Art Murphy, who's the best financial analyst in the movie industry and has done it for Variety for years and years, keeps pointing out that the number of tickets sold over the last 20 years or so hasn't varied more than, maybe 10 million tickets a year. I mean, some not terribly large amount of ticket sales. The box office keeps going up because of ticket inflation, because the prices get higher. Certainly a few million more people went to the movies at some point during this year, but not, you know, enough more to change things. You can't say, yes, America's going back to the movies, and now it's going to be the way it was in 1940, when I believe 245 million people went to the movies every week. It's never going to be that way again because, of course, we have a lot of other entertainments fighting for the consumer's dollar. And we also have inside the home free television for a minimum charge. You have cable television for a little bit more money. You have home box office or Disney Channel, which will give you a lot of extra movies a month. You have video cassettes that in my neck of the woods, which is West Los Angeles, you can rent for $1 a night. And you have baseball games and basketball games and football games. So it's never going to be that kind of halcyon world again.
My guest is Algene Harmetz, and she writes about the business of movie making for the New York Times. We're going to talk more about movies after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Algene Harmetz. She reports on the business of and the personalities behind the film industry. She reports for the New York Times. We've talked about some of the recent trends. Are there any other major trends that you think shaped up in 1987?
Oh, absolutely. And one of them we touched on, and you said that the exhibitors that were showing successful movies were making money, but all the exhibitors really are making money if they own multiplexes, and that's the big thing that's been happening in the movie industry today. I sort of use the catchword that the industry today is about multiplexes and megabucks. And the multiplexes are these new theaters that are being built, many of them in shopping malls, that have 8, 10, 12, 14 separate screens inside them. And the biggest one was just built by Cineplex on the Universal Studios lot, and that has 18 different theaters. Well, what that means is that you have a tremendous number of options. You can play Three Men and a Baby at three or four of your theaters if you want to. You can play it at four theaters one week. Next week, maybe you just play it at three. You also have room to play, Barbra Streisand's Nuts was playing at about three Cineplexes, didn't do well, and then was reduced to one or two screens. You have things like Barfly, Matewan, all the little odd things, Gabby, Anna, little movies that are independent movies that get a place in these multiplexes because they have to fill 14 screens, like the one right across the boulevard from me.
So these multiplexes have increased the demand for more movies. There's more screens available to show them.
There are more screens available, which partly increases the demand for movies, but partly the increased number of movies being produced, you know, has caused the exhibitors to decide to build more multiplexes. But the multiplex is replacing, in many cases, the old Bijou or Regent from Main Street in the town. It provides a lot of flexibility. And since the movies are staggered, it usually means that if you come and you're too late to see whatever movie you wanted to see, that you usually pick something from the other movies playing rather than go home. The multiplexes have also allowed the independent producers a place to display their wares. And it doesn't really help you much if you can make a movie unless you can actually get some place to show it so that people have a chance to see it. And that is one reason that we have this tremendous, overwhelming outpouring this year of independent movies. I think there's a figure that, well, the New York Times, Vincent Canby screened or, you know, watched something like 130 movies in 2 months this year as opposed to 50 last year. That, of course, included the New York Film Festival. But it does give you some feel for the outpouring of movies. And those are mostly independent movies. Major studios have not increased their supply of movies very much.
My big gripe with the multiplexes is that they tend to be small screen theaters.
Maybe that'll change. That's to some extent changing. The first major multiplex here in Los Angeles closed down two of its smaller screens and built two much more massive ones, about 600 or 700 seats apiece, in place of them.
I'm interested in finding out a little bit about your life in the movies. Your mother worked in the costume department for MGM when you were growing up, so I'm sure you got to see the movies a little bit. I guess movies really excited you even when you were a child. Did you decide then that you wanted to be close to them professionally when you grew up?
Oh, I wanted to be a movie star, of course. My idea was that I would write myself a role in which I could win an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay and Best Actress. I started at MGM when I was 12 years old, working in the fan mail department during the summers, stuffing envelopes with little 2x3-inch pictures of the major MGM stars, who at that time were Esther Williams, Lana Turner, and June Allison. and some of the minor ones do.
You started writing for fan magazines, and that means in the period that this was, I guess, the 1950s,
mm-hmm.
you had to go through the studios, the publicity people in the studios. Were there any unwritten rules about what aspects of a star's life you could not cover if you were writing about them?
Oh, absolutely. I will never forget, and this was at the last gasp of the studio system in the mid-50s at MGM, when one of the senior publicists said to me quite seriously, speaking of the female stars at the studio, no MGM star drinks, smokes, or has sex, even with her own husband.
Now, did you follow that? Did you ever try to get around that and actually write the truth about someone, that they did have sex with their husband?
Very quickly, the Confidential magazine came in, and the studios couldn't stick to those rules. Actually, I see my experience in the fan magazines as an earn-as-you-learn time. I really learned how to write profiles and how to do research, and got paid for doing it, and then moved on.
Were writers like you ever punished by the studios if they felt that you violated their code?
Oh, absolutely. I have been barred from several lots in my time, and let me assure you, not all for the fan magazines. I was barred from one studio lot when writing for the New York Times because the head of that studio did not like an article that I wrote, which was Hollywood's impressions of some of that studio's upcoming movies. So nobody would answer my phone calls for 3 months.
So this kind of thing still goes on?
Sure.
How did you get out of the fan magazines? Was it a difficult transition to make?
No, it was very funny. I had written I started out actually writing fiction. I had the first thing I ever published was poetry in the Atlantic Monthly. But moving to articles for the national magazines, the editor of McCall's happened to pass a newsstand where I had a 10,000-word profile of Tony Perkins in a motion picture magazine, and he had recently run a profile of Tony Perkins, so he picked up the magazine to gloat, essentially. That's what he told me later. He just picked it up because he was going to be able to read it and see how much better his profile was. Well, he felt that his profile was much inferior, called me the next day and offered me some assignments writing for McCall's.
That's an interesting story. You know, I think in a way that a lot of movie executives come and go, but that you've persisted. In other words, you've probably seen a lot of studio heads with their heads on the chopping block. Yet you keep your position at the New York Times. It gives maybe you a feeling of security that the people you're writing about don't have.
Well, there was one point where every single studio had changed its top management within the previous 18 months. That was about 5 years ago. It was quite incredible.
Can I ask you to look ahead for a moment to 1988? Do you see any big changes on the horizon in the movie industry?
There are people who feel that this overbuilding, as they term it, of theaters and the oversupply of product is going to eventually cause some sort of collision. And certainly if there's any sort of recession, the movie industry will do quite well because it's a cheap form of entertainment, but there will be some pulling back, and there will be some people who have problems. What we have seen, and what we will see more of, is that the small companies and the new companies that got their money during the last years of this heady stock market rise by just putting out a brochure and saying, hey, buy stock in my company, I'm making movies, that's not going to be possible anymore. And there are a lot of tottery people tottery companies right now. Dino De Laurentiis's De Laurentiis Entertainment Group is midway to crashing onto the floor. Canon, of course, has been in trouble with the SEC and with the public for 2 years now. Whether it will survive is anyone's question.
When you were young, you wanted to be a movie star, and you once wrote that you'd never want to do that now because of how movies have changed.
Well, I would never want to do that now because I think I've matured a little bit. And what I wanted was absolute glory and adulation. What I wanted was people to adore me and to applaud my every move. I'm not sure I ever wanted to be really to be an actress, which is something different. I was a pretty crummy actress, though I did act in high school. I think now that I'd rather have the privacy that isn't possible when you are a public figure like a movie star.
One last quick question. When you're watching a movie, do the politics behind that movie, the politics that you're in the know about, ever affect your appreciation of the film?
Oh, sometimes. I think nobody could have gone into Ishtar without being aware of how much the movie had cost, of all the fights and arguments that had drifted up to public consciousness. I don't know that it would affect whether I thought the picture was good or bad, but I think it's interesting that that picture was probably given less credit than it should have been, because it wasn't a bad comedy. Just wasn't a great movie, but it wasn't a bad comedy. However, the critics could not get beyond the fact that it had cost, with marketing expenses, well over $50 million. And they were indignant that this lightweight piece of fluff, rather flawed, should have been a waste of that much money.
Well, I want to thank you very much for reviewing some of the trends of the year with us and for talking with us about your life. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
My guest has been Aljean Harmetz, and she writes about the business of movies and the personalities behind the movies for The New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.